Hello, I'm Mark Slouth, and welcome to the latest edition of the UFO Insight podcast, where we examine all things UFOs and aliens, conspiracies and mysteries, and all aspects of the paranormal. Okay, today we'll be looking at some of the many accounts from people who claim to have been on board a UFO, a vehicle from another world. And as we'll find, these claims are as fascinating as they are bizarre. Perhaps the first thing we should do is contemplate just how seriously we should take such claims. After all, it is one thing to see a strange craft in the sky, it is another thing to step aboard it. That said, there are many more of these claims than we might think, and we should perhaps treat them as seriously as we treat claims of alien abduction, for example. Incidentally, we'll keep away from typical alien abduction scenarios, not least as they are worthy of an episode in their own right. We will mainly concentrate our time here on encounters of a, by and large, more friendly, or at least less hostile nature. That said, we will start with a case that would appear to almost have been an alien abduction that wasn't. We will begin our examination of these fascinating if bizarre claims with the case of Alfred Bertou. Now, this is arguably one of the most intriguing alien encounters on record. A night fishing trip would turn into one of the most remarkable evenings of 77-year-old Bertou's life. UFO investigator and author Timothy Good spent considerable time with Bertou following the life-changing event. He firmly believed that the incident took place. Even when rumours swirled that Bertou had claimed the affair was a hoax shortly before his death, his wife insisted, after his passing, that his account was true. To the aforementioned Good, she stated he had the look of a man who had seen a miracle happen. In the early hours of August 12, 1983, Alfred Bertou, along with his dog, Tiny, would make his way to the banks of the Basingstoke Canal in Aldershot, England, for a spot of night fishing. The only other person he would see during his journey was a policeman working for the Ministry of Defence on his patrols. By the time he had picked out his preferred spot, the nearby army barracks clock announced it was 1 a.m. Barely a quarter of an hour went by before Bertou's night would take a most dramatic and fascinating turn. While taking a drink of tea from his flask beaker, he noticed a strange light heading towards him. It eventually settled down behind some trees around 300 feet away from his position. He stood to get a better view, dragging on his cigarette as he did so. Tiny began to growl nervously, refusing to obey Alfred's commands for her to stop. It was then he began to make out two strange forms heading his way. Far from being afraid, Bertou's military training, as well as his time spent working in the open countryside of Canada, made his mind more inquisitive more than anything else. According to Bertou, the creatures stopped a mere 5 feet away from him. He and they returned stares for several moments. Bertou would later describe the beings as being around 4 foot high and wearing a pale green coverall from head to foot. Each suit appeared moulded to them. There was no signs of buttons, zippers or any other fasteners of any kind. Each also adorned a helmet, also pale green, and with a visor that was blacked out. After several prolonged seconds, one of the beings motioned with its thin arms for Alfred to follow. It then turned away and headed towards the lights of what Bertou assumed to be their ship. He followed the first being, while the second would follow behind him. They walked the distance to the glowing craft, at one point even crossing a small public footpath. On a quiet out-of-the-way towpath was the source of the glow, a metallic-looking craft around 40 foot wide. It appeared to rest on two ski-type runners, and a set of steps protruded from a porthole in the side. As it had done to beckon him to follow, the form would motion for Alfred to proceed up the steps and board the craft. Even at this point, Bertou maintains he wasn't thinking about UFOs at all. He walked up the steps and went on board the strange ship. He would immediately find himself in an octangular-shaped room. The being in front of him went out of his line of sight. He would later claim when it did, he heard a sound like a sliding door. The other form simply positioned itself near the door. The temperature was noticeably warmer than outside, although not uncomfortable. He could also sense an aroma, not unlike decaying meat. He noticed how the beings moved in a stiff manner, although aside from this, their movements were almost identical to a human's. For the next 10 minutes or so, Bertou stood in silence, doing his best to examine with his eyes his surroundings. The room itself was all comprised of a black material that had the look of unfinished metal. There were no nuts, bolts, or even seams anywhere. it was as if the entire room was a mould from one piece of huge material. Bringing him back to the moment was a sudden rise from the floor of a large shaft. On each side of this were two other beings, exactly the same as the first two who had brought him here. Out of nowhere, a voice would then instruct him to come and stand under the amber light. At first he could not see the light, but as he moved to his right, it was directly in front of him, from floor to ceiling. He did as instructed and stepped into the amber glow. He would stand waiting for further instructions until the voice again sounded. This time, it asked, "What is your age?" Berto informed the unseen owner of the voice that he would be 78 on his next birthday. He was then asked to turn around in the column of light. A further wait ensued until the voice finally called out. "You can go," it said. "You are too old and infirm for our purpose." With that, he matter-of-factly left the craft and proceeded back to his spot on the bank of the canal. As he looked back, he could see a lot of activity on the craft, with several apparatus turning, some clockwise, some anti-clockwise. By the time he was back at his fishing spot, a bright glow would light up the entire area. He turned to see the strange craft shoot off into the sky at fantastic speed, and then it was gone. A look at his watch would tell him that an hour had gone by. According to Bertu, he then settled down to continue what he had ventured out to the canal bank to do, to fish. Around 10 a.m, two mounted Ministry of Defence policemen approached him to make small talk. That was until he mentioned the strange lights and glowing craft, to which one of them replied, "Yes, I suspect you did see that UFO. I expect they were checking out our military installations." With that, they would go on their way, and by shortly after noon, Berto was at home telling his wife of the evening's events, before he retired for an afternoon nap. By October of 1983, however, he would find himself desperate for more information about what he might have seen during the early hours of that August morning. So much so that he would make contact with the local newspaper, the Aldershot News, in search of any other witnesses. From this, the paper ran a story, which in turn found its way to the Surrey Investigation Group of Aerial Phenomena. By November 1983, the case would fall into the in-tray of Timothy Good. Good would speak to Berto at length about the incident, and although he found it frustrating that the ex-military veteran had not thought to ask any questions at all of his hosts, he was stating in his book, Above Top Secret, that he undoubtedly believed his claims. Incidentally, aside from his age, Berto believed his chronic bronchial problems contributed to his release. Had he had a lucky escape, or might he have missed out on a journey of a lifetime? Regardless, his health continued to fail over the following years, until his death on August 31st, 1986. Many UFO researchers have examined the case of Alfred Berto over the years, just one of whom is Hilary Porter, who would reveal some intriguing details. For example, she would notice that over the years there appeared to be an increased military presence in and around the area of Berto's encounter. She claims to have witnessed fully armed units, dressed completely in black. Signs have also appeared, stating that what should be public land is now off limits to the public. In December 2006, while conducting research, Porter took several photographs of the landing area. In one of them, a strange metallic-looking object is clearly visible, despite it not being so to the naked eye. When Porter magnified the strange anomaly, she believed she had caught an ectoplasmic manifestation in the middle of shape-shifting. One other strange thing noticed by Porter is an almost annual article that appears in the local newspaper around the time of the anniversary of Berto's death. It always recounts the incident and then goes out of the way to stress that it didn't happen and that the claims made Berto a laughingstock. Make of that what you will. Although he didn't recall the events until years after they happened, the claims of one-time police officer Herbert Schirmer are also of interest to us here. And while there is some question as to the authenticity of the account, at least according to some, Schirmer didn't attempt to cash in on his claims, rather he shied away from publicity following speaking of the events. According to his ventral recollections, on December 3rd, 1967, while conducting routine inspections along State Highway 63 in Ashland, Nebraska, Officer Schirmer would notice bright lights ahead. Fearing he was about to pull up on an overturned car with injured parties inside, he increased his speed slightly. When he reached the source of the lights, it became clear to him he wasn't looking at an overturned car. In fact, he wasn't looking at a car of any kind. In front of him, hovering several feet from the ground, was a strange oval-shaped object. The craft had a metallic look to its exterior. Sherman would estimate later in the Ashfield Gazette newspaper that the object was at least 20 feet across. The young police officer remained in his position, continually watching the craft. Then, without warning, it vanished upwards in an instant. Sherman returned to the police station and would file a report with his superior officers. Aside from the brief interview given to the aforementioned publication, however, the incident was largely forgotten. That was until a little over 2 months later, when the account came to the attention of UFO researcher Leo Sprinkle. Sprinkle believed, upon reading of the encounter, that the young policeman was likely to have missing time or memories of the evening. He had researched a wealth of UFO cases, particularly ones involving contacts or even abduction. He would travel to Ashland, successfully convincing Sherman to undergo hypnotic regression. This would, in theory, recover the real events of that December evening. Under hypnosis, Sherman recalled heading towards the craft. He did this of his own free will and did not feel scared while doing so. But he would also state his body felt as if it was under the control of someone else. Once inside the otherworldly craft, several beings would greet him. They looked, however, exactly the same as any human being on Earth. Each adorned a uniform that itself had a strange snake insignia on it. Sherman's decision to explore his memories so publicly would have a negative impact on the rest of his life. He would not return to the police force in any capacity. Even worse, many soon viewed him as a typical loon making money from his crazy story. The criticism would grow so great that he would ultimately refuse to discuss the encounter publicly again. Another encounter that comes from the files of UFO researcher Timothy Good is that of Sidney Padrick, who in the early 1960s would not only claim to have been on board a UFO, but would report his claims directly to the United States Air Force. Indeed, much like Shermer, there is division in the UFO community as to how seriously we should take the encounter, and it would indeed prove to be a controversial case. However, according to Good, when he spoke with Padrick, he always found his answers to his questions to be clear and precise, and in a believable tone. In short, it was his belief that the witness was honest. According to Padrick, he would often take late-night walks along the beach in Watsonville, California. His home was nearby, and the late hour most often would mean he had the area to himself, much like he did this evening in late January. It was a little after 2 a.m. when he noticed an outline of a large craft, like two thick saucers inverted, heading in his direction. Just metres away, it came to a rest on the ground in front of him. Gathering his thoughts, his first reaction was to run, which he did. Then a voice rang through the night. "Don't be frightened. We are not hostile," it said. He continued to run, prompting the voice to repeat the statement, before then inviting him on board the craft. He stood there for a moment contemplating what was happening. With ample caution, he walked towards a strange vehicle. As he stepped closer, a door opened, presenting the inside of this mysterious craft for him to explore. He paused a moment, still cautious, before he stepped forward. He would find himself in a small room around 6 by 7 feet before another door opened in front of him. Once again he stepped through, this time into a larger room, where a man no different to a human in basic appearance would greet him. As he looked around to examine his surroundings, he would notice a further 7 men in the room, as well as an extremely pretty woman. He would estimate them, by human standards, to be early to mid-20s, with features almost identical to humans other than a point to their chins and noses. According to Padrick, each adorned a two-piece suit that was blue-white in colour. No zippers or buttons were visible on these tight-fitting suits, and their shoes appeared connected to them. He could hear the sound of their shoes on the rubber-like floors of the room. Each of the crew appeared involved in various jobs, each concentrating on instruments they were working with, including one which Padrick would see first-hand, an oblong lens that appeared to be some kind of highly advanced viewing system, which contained a magnified three-dimensional effect that was their navigation craft, essentially their mothership. Padrick would further remark that where the ship was, it was daylight, so he surmised it was quite some way from their location. At one point, after travelling for around an hour, and according to Padrick's account some 170 miles northwest of their location, his guide would ask him to leave the craft and have a look around, so that he knew that it was real and not a dream. He did so, claiming that the outside of the craft looked metallic, but was not metal, and that the closest thing he could compare it to was plexiglass. He also claimed it was highly polished, something which often shows up in reports of close-up examinations of UFOs. Although all of the beings acknowledged his presence, only the first, the man who greeted him, would speak to him. He would do so in English, offering himself to be the only one on board who could do so. Padgett would recall there was no accent at all to the man's speech. He would also pause for a considerable time before answering any questions Padgett asked. For reasons he couldn't explain, Padgett had the sense that the replies appeared to him as if by telepathy, which he also senses how they communicated with each other, as none of the crew made a sound. Padgett would ask several questions of his guide, including where they came from. The reply was rather cryptic: from a planet which humans observe, but we don't observe them. Padgett would offer that he believed their home planet was in our solar system. When Padgett asked the man his name, he simply replied, "You can call me Zeno." Of course, Zeno is stranger in ancient Greek. During the encounter, Padgett would see a photograph of a city on the planet that the visitors came from. He would describe the buildings in the city as being all rounded off like a half moon. The buildings themselves had distances between them that were seemingly random, not equally spaced as a city on Earth might be. According to Padgett, his guide informed him, "As you know it, we have no sickness, we have no crimes, we have no police force, we have no schools, our young are taught at an early age to do a job, which they do very well. Because of our long life expectancy, we have a very strict birth control, we have no money, we live as one." When he inquired why they had come to Earth, the answer was simply, "Observation only." Padgett would theorise later that he thought they were observing people mostly, adding that there was no mention of impending disasters, political upheaval, or any future events. Interestingly though, he would put forward that he had the impression they will pick up more people in the future. One interesting aspect of Padgett's encounter was an apparent fusion of worship and science, something that would, in many people's minds, be completely at odds with each other. Following various demonstrations of their technical prowess, which at no time in anything than a humble way, Padgett's guide would lead him into a room he would later call a consultation-type room, which was full of colours that defy description. Then the man would ask Padgett, "Would you like to pay your respects to the supreme deity?" There is no description offered as to what this deity might be, or what form it might have taken. Padgett did state, though, that until that night, he had never felt the presence of a supreme being. It is certainly an interesting dynamic to a UFO encounter. Padgett would further state that it was obvious that they were on a very high scientific level, and he believed their religion and their science were one. Padgett offered later that the United States Air Force had insisted he leave out certain aspects of his story. For example, he would claim they did not want him to speak of the beings having no money, crime, or schools. From the United States military's point of view, though, the only reason Padgett approached him with the information of his encounter was purely to lend his otherwise manufactured account some credibility. In short, they believed Padgett to be making up the whole affair, possibly for fame, more likely for money. And a court case in 1971 would appear to lend that assessment some credibility. According to a report in UFO Investigator from April 1971, Sidney Padgett would find himself in a California court following legal action against him over $1,000 he had borrowed from a friend in order to produce a book of his extraterrestrial encounter. After waiting patiently for 6 years, and with no book or even a manuscript evident, the lender of the money wished to retrieve his investment. Padgett would argue that he had given the manuscript to an associate, who had then passed it on to an unknown person, who had since vanished. Incidentally, the judge would rule for him to pay the money back, with interest. This appears to be the last anyone has heard from Sidney Padgett. Whether he simply wished to live out a quiet life, or whether his sudden low profile should be an area for suspicion is up for debate, as is the fact the manuscript went missing. Was he a victim of being too honest by reporting his encounter to the very people who would look to cover it up? Or did the United States Air Force have him banged to rights in their assessment, that he was looking for profit in one way or another from an encounter that never happened? The following incident is just one of over 60 UFO and alien encounters that you can read about in full in our book from deep within the archives of UFO Insight, and occurred in Leeds, West Yorkshire, in the United Kingdom. Shortly after finishing an overtime shift at Bryden's garage, 57-year-old Jan Sedlecki locked up and walked the short distance to his home around the corner. Before the morning announced itself, he would be a part of one of the strangest extraterrestrial encounters on record. What is perhaps stranger still, while most UFO researchers who would investigate the case believed this mechanic to be of sound mind and very truthful, he was the one and only witness to the encounter. This despite events unfolding in the middle of a busy housing estate, next to an equally busy double carriageway. Mark Ian Birdsall would investigate the incident initially for Quest International, as well as highly respected UFO researcher Timothy Good in later years. It was a little after 1 a.m. when Jan Sedlecki set off for home. However, the warm August night in the summer of 1976 brought little chill with it. Besides, he would be on the street for a minute or two at most, such was the short distance to his house. It was likely only a matter of minutes when Sedlecki turned into bed when the bedroom suddenly lit up. At first he feared an explosion outside, possibly even from the garage. He dressed and rushed downstairs. He was eager to make sure he was not responsible for the bizarre events and to see if anyone was hurt. As he looked out of his window, however, he quickly realised he wasn't responsible for the events, nor was there an explosion. There was, however, right across from the house, a dark blue saucer-shaped craft that was descending into the middle of the road. Quickly dressing, he ran from his home and back over York Road, all the while keeping the object in view. He would later report, despite the carriageway being particularly busy, even at 2 a.m, there was rather oddly no traffic whatsoever. He would even state as to looking around the street for other witnesses, but there appeared to be no sign of anybody else. Just when he believed the scene couldn't get any stranger, a translucent tube began to emerge from the bottom of the craft. It continued its descent until it reached the ground. Shortly afterward, two humanoids appeared out of the tube. Each stood at around 4 feet tall and adorned an orange bodysuit and helmet with a dark visor. Before he could summon his legs to move him safely out of sight, one of the beings motioned to him to come forward. Not fully understanding why, he did so. As he approached the two humanoids, he could hear them engaged in conversation, although it was in a language he did not understand. It was then he noticed the two beings pressing buttons on a tablet on their chests. Within moments, they began speaking to him in English. Sedlecki believed these tablets enabled the automatic translation somehow. What is interesting is that in our contemporary era, these types of devices, or translation gadgets and apps, are widely available. They would tell him the reason for the landing was to repair their ship, and they explained as soon as they had did this, they would be on their way. Asking how their ship worked and what the problem was, the humanoid offered, "If you want to come in, we can go now." They turned and went back inside the craft, and Sedlecki followed. As he entered, the smell of rotting grass assaulted him straight away. As he scanned the room in which he stood, he noticed a mini makeshift lake going around the sides. On top of this, there appeared to be some kind of unknown type of grass growing. The humanoid informed him the room was the cooling system. The two humanoids progressed forward, about to go into another room. For reasons he couldn't explain, he thought they were about to enter the engine room of the ship. Asking about the propulsion system, one of the humanoids replied that they used B-13 as a source of power. Then, something even stranger would unfold. Before the conversation could progress further, a bright orange orb appeared around the size of a soccer ball. It would bounce off the walls of the room and would send the two beings and the other crew members into panic. One of the beings motioned that he should leave and would make the rather bizarre statement of there being space bugs in the ship. He was told to run to the place where he was when he first saw them so he would be a safe distance from them. As before, he did as instructed. Once near his garden from where he watched the craft descend, he could now see it rising into the air. On the underside, a bright red glow was evident. A whistling sound steadily increased as if in sympathy with the speed of the craft. At the point when it vanished into the night sky, a loud thunderclap would sound out. Then everything appeared normal, as if nothing out of the ordinary had ever happened. Looking at his watch, he estimated the entire incident to have lasted no longer than half an hour. He returned home and gathered his thoughts, and then woke his wife, who had remained asleep throughout the entire incident. He relayed to her what had happened. She was, however, unconvinced and went back to sleep. One area that many UFO researchers, and indeed Sadlecki himself, would ponder was the fact that only he appeared to have witnessed the event. This despite the sprawling streets of full houses and the normally busy dual carriageway that overlooked the estates. Other reports of a similar nature have wondered whether the alien craft, or something on board it, was able to manipulate the surroundings, including the people in those surroundings, so they remain unaware of their presence. That is perhaps an outlandish suggestion, but it is certainly not that much of a stretch of the imagination to think such advanced beings might have knowledge of a technology we have yet to even comprehend. Even finer details of the craft that Sadlecki would later give, such as there appear to be three different levels and have a presence of other unseen beings, also match many other UFO reports. Jan Sadlecki himself would pass away in 1992. He would, however, never deviate from the initial report of that evening. Many other neighbours and work colleagues would vouch passionately for his credibility. In short, as strange as that evening undoubtedly was in August 1976 on a housing estate in the north of England, most who examine the account suggest it to be authentic. These are just some of the many claims from around the world and across the decades from people who claim to have been on board a UFO. And while these are perhaps far from the typical forced alien abduction accounts that might come to mind when we imagine a journey on a vehicle from another world, they are intriguing nonetheless. We might ask ourselves how many more such encounters might have gone unreported over the years. And if these incidents are taking place even more than we already suspect, then we have to ask, just like the UFO sightings and typical alien abductions, what is the reasons for these cosmic visits and interactions? For now, as always, I will thank you for joining me, and be sure to leave any thoughts in the comments and check out the links for further reading to some of the cases we have been discussing here today. Remember to subscribe to our channel and follow us on social media to keep up to date on future podcasts, articles and videos. And as always, if there is anything you want us to speak about in future podcasts, then just get in touch at marcus@ufoinsight.com. Until next time, goodbye and take care.